Welcome back to After Hours, the first After Hours of 2021, abbreviated though it may be. It is still packed with, this one's pretty eclectic. We just talked to Paul Kendrick about he and his father's book about Martin Luther King in 1960. I'm going to go back even further with my next guest, William Hazelgrove, who's been on the show a number of times because he's one of the most passionate historians and prolific writers that I know. Hi, Bill. How are you?
Hello. I'm doing good.
I'm glad we did this, because when the book came out and I wrote about it in the Tribune, all of a sudden football season came along and my show was knocked off the air for a while. But I have wanted to have Bill on ever since, reading his really remarkable, remarkable book. The title is Sally Rand, American Sex Symbol. Let me take you back, Bill, and you take the listeners back to a time before she was a sex symbol, when she was sleeping in an alley. Helen Beck, and she was in Chicago, and she was sleeping under cardboard in the alleys of the city. What happened to her then?
Okay, right. She ended up in Chicago after her Hollywood career collapsed.
One of the great things about your book is Studs Terkel comes in there, because she had told Studs in a radio interview that the reason her Hollywood career crashed was that she had a voice that belongs in the Eleanor Roosevelt category, and she failed in Hollywood and came here pretty down and out when she got here, wasn't she?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, she was a film star, basically.
Yeah.
The Cecil B. DeMille's.
Yep.
Jazz singer comes out, talkies. He gives her a test. She has a lisp and an Ozark accent. And then the Eleanor Roosevelt voice came in after she tried to take voice lessons, but it never worked.
God.
So essentially, she was making it. She was a Wampus Baby star nominee, but her career just crashes, and she ends up in Chicago, broke. The Great Depression. She's sleeping in an alley, as she said, wakes up, and then she reads about a tryout at the Paramount Club on State Street.
Yeah.
And so she goes to a secondhand store and gets these 7-foot ostrich feathers. You know, just on a whim.
I know. It's an astonishing. The book, I must say, ladies and gentlemen, is really an astonishment on a number of levels. It's not simply about, you know, Sally Rand, that is also about American celebrity and sexual mores. But she goes in, and Bill, is it your feeling that she went in to this store and just, had there not been ostrich feathers there, she might have picked something else, right?
Well, you're right. She actually picked a little outfit to wear behind the ostrich feathers. Mm-hmm. So she gets to the tryout at the Paramount Club. It doesn't fit. The woman next to her says, hey, I would just go on naked. So she does.
Yeah, she does.
Gets the job, go figure, right?
And
all right, so the thing you got to remember about Sally Rand is she always sees herself as a Hollywood star who's going to go back to Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah.
So the biggest show in town, though, is the 1933 Chicago World's Fair, A Century of Progress. And so she goes and tries something. They say, you know, we don't need you. And so then she hatches a plan, and she gets a boat, a white horse, paints her entire body in white makeup. That's it.
Yeah.
A cape.
Uh-huh.
Right? And for your listeners, the Chicago World's Fair was on Norley Island.
Yeah.
So she gets in the boat. It's the opening night. All the muckety mucks are there. There's a big stage. She gets in the boat with the horse, takes her around to a yacht landing. The guy thinks she's part of the show. She gets off, gallops through the World's Fair grounds, all the way to the stage, opening night. The horse jumps up onto the stage, rears up. All these photographers take a picture. They go, oh my God, a naked woman. It's the Chicago World's Fair.
Yeah.
She gets immediately arrested and then immediately hired and becomes the number one financial draw of the Chicago World's Fair.
You make a quiet and thoughtful case that she helped to make the Century of Progress a successful World's Fair. She was, and it's always been my contention, she was the main draw there. I mean, my father was 19, a student at the University of Chicago, and he wound up going to see Sally Rand. That says something about it. But she did help make that fair, did she not, in the middle of the Depression?
Absolutely. And, you know, here's the thing. She literally took the fare from the red into the black.
Yeah.
And, of course, the money's going directly into Chicago because Chicago's broke.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
And she's getting arrested four times a day for indecency during this, all right, and keeps getting dragged down to the same courtroom. And the judge finally goes, you know what, I've had enough. I'm going to see the show. He goes to see the show, comes up to, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Never bring her back to my courtroom.
I know, it is. You must have, when you came upon, I know you spent an inordinate but valuable amount of time at the Chicago History Museum digging through these 61 boxes that
right.
comprise Sally Rand's archives. What was it? I know you've written another book about the World's Fair and the Capone connection with it.
Right.
But what was it about Sally? When did Sally Rand begin to seem to you to be the stuff of a book rather than a long magazine article? Was it in the archives or was it before?
I was doing the Capone book, and then thank God those 61 boxes are there. So I sort of switched over and started. What intrigued me was this. Why did all these people come to see her? And I mean, she was doing 17 shows a day, seven minutes long. Why was that happening? Well, it's because, you know, we can escape any way we want. We get into Netflix or whatever.
No,
this
sure.
is the worst year of the Great Depression.
Yep.
But for 7 minutes, you went there and you watched this woman dance under a blue light to classical music, you know, behind these feathers, and you were gone, men
yeah.
and women.
Yeah.
So she was very much a symbol of hope, you know, especially in that Horatio Alger motif of rags to riches. It's very much the early century of the United
sure.
States.
Sure.
You know, we're sort of looking for something brighter, and, you know, this, like the times now.
Yeah.
With this pandemic.
No, I think that's true. There's a lot of stuff in this book that I find, I reread it about a week ago, that resonates in today.
Right.
The other thing, that one thing that doesn't resonate in today is the number of newspapers that were in Chicago at the time. And the newspapers just loved Sally Rand, did they not?
That's right.
Yeah.
She was a media darling, and every time she got arrested, she got covered.
Yeah,
and that brought in more people. So she loved that. You know, she was one of the first work to be famous for being famous.
Yeah, you make that point wonderfully in the book. I just want to read one. There, I could read 100, but one critic described the act, and it was only, again, as Bill says, 7 minutes long, as, quote, perfectly beautiful as presented and lighted, airy, exquisite, artistic. So adept is Miss Rand with her fans, so cunning the hand at the colored light switch, that you are good if you can tell where her body starts and her fans stop. That's an incredible, incredible review. You would think, though, and this is the thing that really grabbed me about Sally Rand at the time. She was dancing in Chicago at the World's Fair and at the Chicago Theater simultaneously, that she would have gone on from there to become, she was as famous could get in that time,
right.
Yes?
Right.
You would think that she might go on to something even more famous, to use that fame to elevate herself into, she is kind of an icon, but beyond that, that did not happen. And I think that part of the story, too, is to my mind, a fascinating one. It is this, you know, how quickly celebrity can evaporate. We will continue on with William Hazelgrove, one of my favorite authors and favorite radio guest. He's written, we'll talk about his other books too, but you can go to WilliamHazelgrove.com and find out even more. But the book we're talking about now is Sally Rand, American Sex Symbol. I don't know if there has ever, I can't even imagine, Bill, had there been television and internet and all this stuff, she would have made the Kardashians look like fishmongers or something. We will be back with Bill, and he'll tell us what happened after the triumph of the Columbia of the World's Fair in 1933 and 34. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back. This is Rick Hogan. My guest is the passionate historian and prolific author William Hazelgrove, and we're talking about Sally Rand, the subject of his latest book, Sally Rand, American Sex Symbol, published by Lions Press. She has become a huge international, I would say, sensation at the World's Fair in Chicago, the Century of Progress exhibition along the lakefront in 1933 and 34. And as I wrote in a review of the book, for all the flash and feathers and fleeting moments of happiness she experienced, there's a palpable sadness shadowing her life. And as Mr. Hazelgrove writes, Sally Rand was at the cutting edge of the early 20th century sexual revolution because her livelihood depended on people thinking she was naked behind the fans. And she could not monetize. She worked her tail off. And this is one of the great troopers of entertainment in entertainment history, isn't she, Bill?
Oh yeah, she had that very much. Yeah, you know, she was very much a blue collar sort of hero who came up and she worked all the time. And of course, right after the fair, you know, she goes on a tour basically. And, you know, she sort of, Rick, was compared to a one hit wonder band.
Right, okay? Right. Yeah, sure.
She goes to cash in on it, but at the same time, she's asked by Harvard to speak to the incoming freshmen.
I know.
You know, so she had the ability. She wasn't stupid. She didn't complete high school, but she was self-taught. So she would morph herself into this other person, go do these speaking engagements, talk to many women's groups, and then, as you know, as time moved on, this is what's fascinating about her, she stayed relevant for 40 years.
Yeah.
You know, to tell the truth, the dating game, attacks Avery, Warner Bros. Looney Tune cartoon was built all around her, called Hollywood. So she stayed relevant with an act that began when she crashed the World's Fair in 1933.
Yeah, and she was, for those of you who remember, and I hope many of you do, Tom Wolfe's magnificent 1979 book, The Right Stuff. He writes in there of the parade in Houston welcoming the first Apollo astronauts to the world. Bill writes in his book that around 2 in the afternoon, as the lights dropped, a band picked up and the spotlight centered on two giant ostrich feathers, and a 60-year-old Sally Rand began to dance. That scene haunted me in the book and the movie, and I'm sure it haunts you on some level too, yes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, here she is. She asked to head up the mission to the moon.
I know.
Okay. Yeah. Think about that. So they saw her emblematic as flight on a national basis. Yeah. You know, so really, this stripper has been held up with, there's Lyndon Baines Johnson and everybody. It's going to be Houston Control. It's really at the Houston Coliseum. And there's Sally Rand. As you say, at 60, dancing, kicking off our mission to the moon.
It's an astonishing, I mean, you know, the most creative fiction writer could not really come up with this kind of life. She had a bad time, though, with guys, did she not?
Oh, yeah. You know, Rick, we always believe fame and fortune go together. They do not.
Yes. Good point.
Right. It's really a study of fame, too, because fame is very fickle. It touches some people and doesn't touch others. Yeah. Now it touched Sally Rand, but fortune does not chase fame. And so she was continually broke, continually had legal suits, continually hounded for money. And she picked three terrible men who drained her of all her money. She always wanted to live a middle-class life, so she adopted another stripper's baby, but it was never really hers.
Yeah.
So it's that illusion. You know, it's the illusion that Sally Rand creates that is her life.
Yeah, you have written about some amazing people in your career, Bill. You've written about, Edith Wilson, who became
Madam President,
but Teddy Roosevelt, the Wright brothers. Where does certainly, it's a sort of a cliche to call Sally Rand an American original, but you seem to have a real abiding admiration for this woman, do you not?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, because she was a hillbilly from the Ozarks. Yeah. She runs away with the circus three times, gets all the way to the West Coast, and meets Cecil B. DeMille, and soon she's on her way to being a Hollywood star. That that crashes. And then, you know, just when things are awful and she's down on State Street, the seedy bar, she crashes the Chicago World Fair. It's a very American story because she never, ever gives up her dream of becoming rich and famous.
Yeah, and it's all, you know, it's all in the whole notion of the American notion of reinvention. And she is, she is a classic example of that. I'm going to read something that I wrote at the end of my review, and you can, those of you who subscribe to the Tribune, just go in the archives and look up Rick Kogan and Sally Rand, or Rick Hogan or William Hazelgrove. I've written about Bill a number of times because I've been charmed and enlightened. I've been enlightened by your books. I have the whole pack of them. I wrote that her final performance, Sally Rand's final performance, came in 1977 at a pageant in the California town in which she had long lived. She did have enough money at one point to buy a kind of place in Glendora, which she purchased when she was flush. She died there on August 13, 1979. She died in a hospital where she had an outstanding bill of $10,000. Within days, that bill was paid by, again, the circle of life, by Sammy Davis Jr., who, as a young performer on the road, Sally Rand had once been kind to him, and he remembered. That's a bit of history that... you can't invent. You just simply can't invent. Right. What's been, Bill, the response to the book? I think I'm hoping that people will read it because it is a multi-layered book about celebrity and the wicked nature of fame. Have people gotten that, Bill, do you think, who have been reading the book?
It's amazing because you kind of think, oh, Hazelgrove slipped off the wagon. He went from writing about Teddy Roosevelt to Sally Rand. But those two crossed paths, of course, when she was 3 years old and up in his lap falling asleep.
Yep. I know.
You remember that? So yep. In terms of response, it's been great. What's interesting is the Daily Telegraph did a huge article on it, and I'm doing a talk Europe next week. So she has this fascination. People have a fascination with her because, again, she's somebody who, at a time when they had, you know, Busby Berkeley films and the Gold Diggers, mm-hmm. which was, you know, poor women snagging rich husbands, Sally Rand made the equivalent of $1 million today. Yeah. She monetized her own act. She was her own manager. She was always self-sufficient. She supported her entire family. I mean, she did things that women at that time couldn't dream of doing.
Sure. Has this been difficult? Let me ask you about trying to promote a book in these these lockdown times in which we live. I mean, that is a, because you are a great guest, whether it's television, internet, whatever. But has that made it more difficult? I mean, you also give, and you're great at giving live presentations, which we don't do anymore. It's a Zoom presentation. How has that changed for you? How has that been for you?
Well, you know, you adapt or die.
Yeah, true.
You know, so I went to doing Zoom presentations as everybody else, and I, like you said, I give lots and lots of those.
Mm-hmm.
So I converted maybe 50 of them to all Zoom. So, you know, still speaking to the libraries and all that. And, of course, you know, if it's a good story, they want to hear it. Is it more difficult? Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I can't be standing in Barnes & Noble anymore, which I did all the time before.
But I know.
You know, right? So we'll come back to that. I mean, bringing books out in a pandemic is a little bit like bringing it out in the middle of a hurricane with a forest fire burning behind you.
Yeah,
you know, but you know, it's the times we're living in. And again, Sally Rand, I felt, again, it's like sort of that story of all the time. This sort of reflects that year when she crashed into the World's Fair and all that darkness was there. I mean, and I'd still bump into people who saw her and they'd say, you know, she was great. You know, she was amazing. You know, because for a few minutes I was gone.
Yeah,
you know,
transported somewhere else. Sure,
absolutely. And I think we can relate to that. Finally,
no question. What? Because you are also so prolific. Without giving some other author the chance to steal your next idea. what are you working on?
No worries. Actually, there's another book coming out in the fall. called Morristown, The Hardest Winter, The Secret Plot to Kidnap George Washington.
Wow. Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. Who wanted to kidnap him?
Actually, the British, because what happened is, in 1779, this is for everybody who wants to steal it, the Hudson
Yeah, go ahead and do the research, you fools.
Yeah, exactly. Start recording. So the Hudson froze, and the British saw it as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to end this war that had dragged on. And so they 700 troops, shot across the Hudson, and Washington was up in Morristown, New Jersey, and they had this whole campaign to get up there and grab him and steal him and end the war.
Wow. Well, from Sally Rand to the Revolution. That's one of the reasons I greatly admire you, Bill. I hope you know that. You're not just a passionate believer and passionate historian. You are a great writer. You can read latest. My pleasure. Sally Rand, American Sex Symbol, WilliamHazelgrove.com. Keep researching and keep writing. And what was the most interesting thing? You actually, and you talk about it in the book too, you actually held the fans. I mean, you saw them and held them.
Yeah, the curator of the Chicago History Museum said, you want to come down and see the fans? So we went all the way down into this huge freezer under it. Right?
Yeah, I've been down there,
You've seen that, right? So we walk along, there's a white box. He opens it up. He goes, there's Sally Rand's fans from 1933. So I take a picture, and he points to some glasses. And he goes, you know what those are? I go, no. He goes, that's Leopold's glasses from the Leopold Loeb murder.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I know. Wow. I know. Well, when you make history come as alive as any author I know out there. William Hazelgrove, it's always a treat. Can't wait for the next book.
Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. Happy New Year.